This is Case 13 from Entangling Vines, which is a collection of koans used in the Rinzai school. And it's the last one used in the traditional Rinzai way of training. And part of what's interesting about this collection is that it's a Japanese collection, which means it's many centuries newer than the Chinese collections, and is kind of reflects centuries of how students and teachers have worked together on koans. A new edition of this book is coming out in the spring of next year. It's a really powerful collection. Case 13. Lungzhang's Hell. Sri Lungzhang asked Joshu Chongshen, "Do enlightened teachers ever fall into hell?" "I'll be the first to go there," replied Jiazhou. "But you're an enlightened teacher," said Lungzhang. "Why would you fall into hell?" "If I didn't fall into hell, how could I help you?" Jiazhou answered. "I'll be the first to go there. If I didn't fall into hell, how could I be of service?" So one thing, this phrase that the translator here, Tom Kirshner, translates as enlightened teacher, he footnotes as the Japanese translation of Kalyanamitra, which is the Sanskrit word for a good and wise friend, a spiritual friend. And in a way, I like that because it lowers the bar of specialness for us. And it's also, and this is what being a good and wise friend, spiritual friend, this is what we are for each other. This is what our teachers are for us. This is the way we can show up as ourselves in this life. And then I also like that just the good and wise friend is itself the only definition of an enlightened teacher. There's not another thing. So the monk is kind of saying, so I find myself falling into hell a lot, and that obviously can't be it. That obviously is an indication that I am not engaging in this practice correctly. So do people like you, who are clearly got it going on, man, do you ever fall into hell? And Joshua is very clear here. Yes. Yes. And what I like about Joshua's response, "I'll be the first to go here." Here, yeah. Is the willingness, the enthusiasm. I also want to say, please feel free to sit comfortably and turn in this direction if you like. There's the willingness, the inclusiveness, the willing to be first into the morass of suffering, first to fall on his face, first to stumble, first to hurt. You're an enlightened teacher. Surely, you should be beyond all that. Why would you fall into hell? If I didn't fall into hell, how could I help you? There's a way. There's a way that we can hear this as condescending, but I really don't think that's the way Joshua is saying it. If my practice is not about practicing in excruciating mind states, in grief and pain and self-flagellation, hatred, if that isn't part of my practice, how can anything I say be useful to all of the beings who are also in pain? If there's some other practice that enlightened teachers do, what good is that to us? And this is such a clear expression of the bodhisattva heart, willingly taking on suffering on behalf of others, willingly taking on suffering, willingly bearing witness, being present to, open to, broke open by pain and suffering and grief for all beings. This is the bodhisattva way. It's not, the bodhisattva way is not being an enlightened teacher in the heaven realms above it all. The bodhisattva way is the first into hell. Specifically, this reminds me of Jizo Bodhisattva in Sanskrit, Kishitagarbha. Jizo, first of all, is the only of the four main bodhisattvas who manifests as a monk. But his practice, he has vowed to empty out all the hells. He goes into hell repeatedly. Or his vow is to completely fill up hell with his own hell practice. In Buddhist cosmology, there's many Buddhas, each with a name and a role and stuff. Shakyamuni is just one among many. There's another Buddha whose name is the Buddha who sits in hell. For me, there's a I'm going to say that I value hell practice, which is different from me saying it's great and awesome and I like it and you should really get you some of this. Totally not saying that. If I were in charge of everything in the universe and I could decide if you want to do hell practice or not hell practice, like all of you, I would totally choose not hell practice. Nobody's ever offered me that choice, really. And in light of the fact that nobody's ever offered me that choice, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of hell practice. And though I don't like it, I value it. And part of what I value about it is, you know, it's kind of like how the, you know, people like crazy zealot Zen monks of the past, like, you know, Hakuin, would like sit on a plank in a tree, you know, and over a, I don't know, in such a fashion that if they fell asleep, if he fell asleep at all, he would tumble off his plank and injure himself greatly. So he manufactured that situation for himself so that he would be awake, you know, so it would be a matter of life and death for him. He would just really practice. Hakuin's an interesting example because his practice was entirely motivated by fear of hell. So, but for me, hell practice is a little bit like a natural occurrence of that kind of thing. Because if hell practice, when it really, really, really just incredibly sucks to be me, in a I can't do anything about this at all to fix it kind of way, any amount of resistance, any amount of trying not to be in hell is like stepping onto lava, and it just intensifies so much my pain. And so this is, and that, seeing how that's true helps me really just stay intimately present with the sucking to be me. It doesn't stop sucking to be me. But there is a way of holding that pain that is palpably, experientially, qualitatively different than giving oneself entirely to trying to escape and giving oneself entirely to wishing it was different. Doesn't mean that the impulse, the desire for it to be different, the impulse to try to escape, it doesn't mean that these don't arise. And I'm not trying to set this up as a special way of being in hell. It really is just a full and complete acknowledgement of, okay, I am here. This may be it for me. I may never get out of this excruciating mind state and circumstance. And there's a surrender. And there's another way. So with this, I'll be at first to go there. There's a way that it's kind of willingly requesting that which is inevitably coming at you. You can't change the fact that it's coming at you, but you can change. You can welcome it. You can receive it. You can choose it. Even though you couldn't choose not it, you can choose it. And this is the liberation of being free to be bound. It is also related to the practice of Tonglen, where we breathe in our suffering and the suffering of all beings who are suffering in the way of us. Breathing that in, taking that on willingly, and then giving away any benefit, any small thing, any small iota of grace. But this breathing it in, taking it in, breathing in our suffering, breathing in the fumes of hell. This lets us be good and wise spiritual friends to each other and ourselves. Somebody said to the Buddha, there's some version of this in the Pali Canon, I'm going to get it a little bit wrong, but somebody said to him, so I hear you saying that having good and wise spiritual friends is an important part of the spiritual path. And Buddha said, no, I didn't say that. Having good and wise spiritual friends is all of the path.
Before I start commenting on this koan, I wanted to just welcome you all. We're a small and intimate group, and it reminds me of, last year, about a year ago now, I did a trip to Nova Scotia, and it was a sea kayaking trip, and was solo. So I paddled out along the coast, becoming more and more distant from any human beings. It's a very remote area. And finally, I had reached the point in Nova Scotia which was farthest from any other humans that you could get in that province. And I camped there. And this was a place where, in front of me, there was just ocean, as far as you could see, and sky. And behind me, on the land, there was this vast barrens. Not enough soil there for anything to grow on except for just a little low ground cover. So you could see for a long, long way. It felt like this big open space went on endlessly. Just me there. And later, a friend asked me, she said, it must be terribly lonely. Do you take any, like a little stuffed animal or something to keep you company? And I said, no, it's not like that at all. In fact, the entire world was there with me, but I couldn't invite them all into the tent at night. And that's how it feels to me sitting here now, that the entire world is sitting with us. It's not just us. It's us and all beings. So I welcome you all. So as I was... When Josh and I decided to speak on this koan, I just sat with it for a little bit to see what would come up around it for me, what I might be able to offer. And there was a memory that arose, and I'm not sure that it's entirely relevant, but I'll honor the fact that it's what came up and offer it to you. Back about 30 years ago, it must have been, more than that, I became pregnant for the first time. Great jubilation. I'd been married for 10 years, and a baby was very welcome. So, wait for one moment here. Oh, you fit right into the story. So I was pregnant, and it was newly so, just a few months in. And at about the and everyone was happy, you know, my husband and I. It was much excitement. And then about 4 months in, I lost the baby. And it had never occurred to me that that could even happen. It's the sort of thing no one talks about, so it's not really right there in front of you. So I grieved quite a bit. I mean, it's a very private sort of grief because at that point only you know this other person who was part of you. A month went by and I still wasn't, I was still grieving and I felt so, as though it were the ultimate failure. Because, I mean, here we are, this species, how we continue is to have offspring. It's the basic thing that you have to be able to do, right, as a biological entity. And I had failed it. and I had failed this tiny creature that I had so wanted to nourish and harbor, and I hadn't been able to do that. So I worried and blamed myself and felt just all kinds of unhappinesses and agonies about it. And this went on as we tried to become pregnant again and failed. Went on for about 6 months. And finally, I realized that I could not center my life around this issue, that I'd lived, up to that point without children, and that I could certainly continue to do so. And it was time to accept that this might not be my path, being a mother, and to get on with things. And so, of course, as soon as I really accepted that, I became pregnant again, and that baby is my son, who's 30 now, so that worked out great. but that's not the end of the story. About 10 or 15 years after that first baby was lost, I was working, and I needed to have a poster made and that had to do with a project I was working on. And the company that I was working with had a separate division that did graphics like that. So I took the file for the poster over to that building and spoke with the person there and said, here's what I want to have done. And she was looking at me sort of intently, like not really listening to what I was saying, but just studying me. And she said, did you used to work at the Natural Foods, the Whole Foods Co-op in town? And I said, well, yeah, way back a long time ago when I was pregnant with my son, I volunteered there. And she said, I thought it was you. I thought it was you. And tears started to come down her face. It's like, who is you? I didn't know who this woman was. And she said, I went there one time. It was just after I had lost my baby. And you were there. And you sat down and talked with me about it and about, how difficult it had been for you and what you went through and that, now you were pregnant again and this baby was okay. And she said, you can't imagine how much it helped me. I suffered so much over the loss of that baby. And what you said to me got me through. And then she took me back to her office and showed me the picture of her daughter. She had become pregnant again after that. She was so thrilled to be able to show me, that she had this, was able to have this lovely daughter. And, I mean, she just sobbed through this whole thing. It meant so much to her, and I felt terrible that I couldn't even remember the incident. But it was, for me, an example of how falling into hell was the way that others could be helped, that I could reach them there where they were. And certainly others have helped me that way. I think this is how self-support groups get started. Somebody finds themselves in some hideous hell and somehow finds a way out and wants no one ever to have to suffer like that again. And so they offer their experiences and what they learn from it to others. And so, of course, we do the same thing here. It reminded me of... when Josh was ordained, that's what it was, your ordination. There's an opportunity during the ordination, at least they used to do this, I don't know if they do anymore, but it was a little different for Raymond. But James offered anyone who wanted the opportunity to speak out any objections they might have to this person being ordained. And so my hand shot up. And I told about how Josh's many failings. I'd known him for a good 6 months, and already he'd wrapped up quite a list. And about how he had, we had the David come to speak in our Sangha one time. David is one of the guiding teachers, and so it was a very big deal. It's the first time he had come to Waldo since I had been there anyway. So he came, and pretty much from the beginning of the sitting right on through, Josh developed this very loud case of hiccups. Hiccup through the whole thing. everyone's trying to be so, you know, zen, and we're here with the teacher, and Josh is just hiccuping his way through, can't stop. And then another time he told us, during a Dharma talk, he told us this rather long and involved story to illustrate. And it was a Zen story, and he completely butchered it, complete so badly he could not finish it, and had to come back the next week and read it to us so we'd have some idea what it was about. And I thought, this is the teacher for me. This is somebody I can identify with. If this guy can be a teacher, there's hope for me. It's not the people who are perfect and who sail through life who are helpful to us. They are not our teachers. It's the ones who stumble and fall, but pick themselves up and keep going, stumble again and again. They're the ones who are useful. I think about how we, or at least how I have approached practice in the past, which was that there's these enlightened beings who have somehow achieved a goal. They have gotten to this place. It all makes sense to them. They can do the right things. And then there's those of us who are the deluded hell realm beings who just have no clue and get it wrong all the time. And one way is success and one way is failure. And we aim for success, and to the extent that we fail, you know, well, we can hold that against ourselves on the grand tally. And it occurs to me that this is the not only not helpful to look at it that way, but I think it's an example of one of the three poisons, that grasping, aversion, and certainty. It's a certainty that we know what the goal is, what the aim is, what it looks like. When someone says, what we think our practice should be. And it's a really insidious one. It's something that for a long time I never even questioned. Of course, this is the way it should be, and here I am failing, and it's wrong. But I don't think it is a fail and success kind of situation. I think it encompasses all of it. There's not a necessity to be one or the other. And in fact, it's just not possible. So we take the path that we're on. And that's the right one. Can't be anything else. This universe doesn't make mistakes. Life is as it is. I think I'll end here. And because we're such a small group, it would be, we have lots of time for discussion and comments and questions. So please feel free.
And sharing and whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you. First of all, I know and appreciate that feeling of being alone but with the whole world. I walk to my spots, but instead of kayaking.
Same deal.
and that's such a great story. That's exactly what was going through my mind as Josh was giving his talk. There's the willingness to go to hell, or I guess maybe just the wisdom to know you're going to be there at some point. Then, to be that good and wise friend, you have to have the courage to share what you've been through. And I was thinking, you know, this about several years, particularly between the death of my father and the death of my mother, where I assumed this is hell. That's where I'm at, you know, it's tough to be me. And now I look at that and I'm feeling more at peace with my own life, but I see a make the scene for the other people suffering and experiencing some of the same things I was experiencing, and I'm able to realize I didn't go through that. I didn't know what these people were talking about. I didn't maybe be able to share that feeling. But however that way, so I feel like I'm hearing two different sort of things about going to hell. On the one hand, hearing that in a certain way it's unavoidable to go to hell, to find yourself in the trash of excruciating mental states from time to time. And so that's one thing. And then the other thing that I'm hearing is about being willing to go to hell. Which one way you talk about that, Josh, is welcoming it when it comes. But that seems a little bit different than what is a Joshi, and what Joshi is saying in the poem. The poem sounds like what he's saying. If you just take it at its surface value, it's that I don't have to go. I don't have to. But I will go because from that place I can tell you where I will be at this point to go. Because if I didn't, how could I help? So I feel like I'm hearing two different things. I'm not sure.
Do you think maybe that Joshua could have opted out of hell?
I don't know. It sounds to me like he's implying that, though. It sounds like he is implying that, in what he says. So I'm just wondering about those sort of two different takes on it that I'm sharing with there. If you're seeing them, you two or anyone else has seen them, how they relate to each other.
I heard it the same way, and I think there's maybe value in looking at both of those. I don't think there's any one way that it has to be taken. I don't so much identify with the one who says, well, I ought to meet you there. You know, I wouldn't have to, because usually I'm kicking and screaming my way toward that surrender. You know, it's resistance all the way until the resistance is so incredibly painful that I have to give in to it. So that's my avenue into that koan. Maybe you have another way. I hope.
If every time Joshu were falling into hell, if in each of those times he chose it, there would never be a time when he was kind of in hell against his will. I'll be the first to go there. We got to get right on that. And as for a practice, so, you know, is Joshu, could he just have heaven practice instead? Could he never have, could he have a life of no hell practice ever, except when he electively goes there for somebody else? I don't know. I can't. And so whether or not this is Joshua's path, this is a matter of that these are the paths of the saints, if that's so. And there is a path of the saints. And in an important way, all of Theravada Buddhism is a path of the saints. And even within Mahayana Buddhism, you know, there are saints and saintly practice. And I don't, that's not an option for me. I have the path of the foolish being. I have the fat path of the constantly tripping on a rock and falling into hell. And this teaching is useful to me, irrespective of whether or not there's some other class of being. And my experience of the type of enlightened teacher who claims never to go into hell, never to be in difficult mind states, never to always have access to the 33rd jhana samadhi. Those teachers very easily drag their students into hell. So we can be grateful that Joshua's willing to go there. Which isn't to say this practice is nothing. Which isn't to say that that there isn't a practice that we do as foolish beings, as hell beings, in hell. This isn't to say there's no practice, and it isn't to say that the liberation that you can experience isn't real and a relief. But it isn't the relief of not being in hell. It's a relief of finding the way to be in hell right now, which is something. It's not nothing.
And those Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not anything other than ourselves. This is just a way of speaking about a certain quality, I guess you could say, of ourselves, aspect of. And so, we should read the koan to you so you know what we're referring to. But given that, how would you answer, I don't know your name, sorry,
Matthew's
question? Is this something that one voluntarily does, one chooses, or is it simply that life throws us there again and again, like it or not? And by surrendering to that, it's not hell anymore. But why don't we redo the poem?
A monk asked Joshua, "Do enlightened teachers ever fall into hell?" "I'll be the first to go there," said Joshua. "But you're an enlightened teacher. Why would you fall into hell?" "If I didn't fall into hell, how could I help you?" Joshua said. Because fall has a non-voluntary quality to it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it more?
Yeah. And I think that is what he means.
So it's sort of old. You can't avoid it, but you can choose it. Not choosing it.
Well, should you choose to meet it?
Yeah.
Right. You can't avoid it. You can choose it. You can also not choose it, but not choosing it is way worse.
Yeah.
And so what you can do is choose to choose it. You can't choose to not do it. I mean, you can also choose not to.
If you're not trying not to choose it, you're just, it's that self again. I'm trying to find a practice for me, whereas the Bodhisattva way is maybe, like as you were saying, coming back across to help. So you're choosing to choose what you can. What you have to choose anyway, and the Bodhisattva help you want to be there.
Yeah, and I don't know about for you, but for me, when I'm doing that falling, the last thing on my mind is how I can save other beings.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that having fallen and having met that, you know, ultimately, after a lot of pain, choosing to go with it, somehow out of that comes saving all beings without making effort toward it.
Yeah, also,
yeah. Yeah, and we
it happens just like hell happens.
Hell happens. You know, and we also see this. We also see this on Sesshin, right? So, you know, we're sitting there having just this totally hellish, awful Sesshin, and then at the end of the week, when we're all talking to each other again and the session's over, the person sitting next to us says, "Thank you so much for your practice. It was so helpful to me. I really was struggling there for a while, but you were just solid." Yeah. and even when people... you know, have had periods where they're just sitting on their cushion and sobbing. Then people have say, "Thank you for that. That was really powerful." And you hear it at the end of session, and we hear it continually when we're doing interviews. So, although I appreciate that saving other beings is the last thing on your mind, doesn't mean it's not happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also for me, on these excruciatingly painful sessions, one of the top, I'm going to say the top one most excruciating session for me was the one in which I was ordained. That was just non-stop hell practice for me. Non-stop self-hatred. Non-stop total inadequacy. And I was a server for Oryoki in that session. And I was like, I totally suck. I completely suck. But I am just really going to serve this person. I've got this soup. Put in one ladle of that. And like giving my whole heart to this little thing, even with all of my hell baggage of inadequacy, had an impact on me. And also on people commented. But so there, it's like there's a way that if I'm going down here, I'm gonna go out doing the crappy best that I can.
So I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to bring that spirit to. You know, here I am. You know, it's not a choice that I made. I'm here in hell. What if this is my practice? Is hell practice? You know, what can I do, given where I am? You know, there is a way that I can serve anyone, even in this hell. But what came up for me is this other idea of it seems to me that we should be able to do something about this. I mean, we're told over and over again that
should.
Yeah, okay, but let me run with it, please. We're told that this idea of self that we have is fundamentally a delusion. That we're creating this separation between self and other, and that this is the source of the problem. This is where the suffering, this optional suffering comes in. Is that we create this idea of self, and we have ideas of how we should be other than we are, and it creates all this suffering, this self-doubt that you were talking about, this feeling less than, why can't I do it, and other people seem to be able to do it, and I can't. Aren't we supposed to be able to ask ourselves, well, you know, who is this being that, you know, feels less than, you know, who is that? You know, why are we creating this ego self and suffering because, you know, we're not measuring up to some idea that we have? You know, it seems to me we should be able to make some progress on letting go of this delusion of self, and that should bring some benefit. What about that? I mean, that's a fundamental idea in Buddhism, right? That I mean, there is this path of, I could go live in a cave and purify myself, you know, and I don't know whether I can actually do it or not, but I mean, that's a, you know...
Sure, that's Theravada Buddhism.
Right, right. So that's a traditional Buddhist idea, you know, that I could attain this way of non-suffering, and then the Bodhisattva says, oh, well, yes, okay, so maybe I could attain that, but I'm going to volunteer not, you know, I'm going to live in the world anyway, and living in the world creates suffering. You know, you can't live in the world with human beings and relationships and not suffer. So yes, to that extent, I'm volunteering. You know, but even there, it should be possible to lessen this burden of self that we carry around. I mean, what is up with that? You know.
Have you not found it possible to lessen that burden?
Not really, no. No, I find myself very much wrapped up in this idea that I should be better than I am.
And what would it mean if I answered that as, yes, you're right, you should be. There should be a way. You should be able to do it.
Well, then I feel like, okay, so I've failed. Josh says there's a way, and I can't figure out what the hell it is.
And so you failed. And then what?
Comes and goes. But it comes up over and over and over again.
It does.
It does. So feel, you know, whenever you set a goal, whenever you make a vow, there's always falling short, right? And there's nothing that we can do about that, right? It's falling short. Fine. But there's this idea that I should, you know, that I shouldn't. You know, that it shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't feel bad. You know,
But the feeling bad is just another hell that's arisen in this moment. First there's this hell, which is the hell of whatever, pain or can't sleep or something, or anger. And then there's the hell of frustration about, you know, not being not in that hell. And there's just... This is why in Buddhist cosmology there's innumerable hells.
But I just feel like I shouldn't be all wrapped up in this self-centered nonsense, you know. I mean, why am I so stuck in that? You know, there should be a through this practice there should be a way to lessen the grip that has on me, you know.
So.
You mentioned support groups, and the immediate thought that came to my mind was this practice is like a support group
yeah.
Life.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know how much that is, but
you're
right.
Right.
Somehow that everyone in here is saying that I need that.
So this question of why, you know, that's always kind of a problematic one. Because it sort of sends you off in unhelpful directions trying to find the reason. When the fact is, here you are. This is what you have to work with. The should is just something that gets imagined because we can imagine something other than the way things are. But the fact is, here it is. It is this way. Here we are all with you, meeting you in health now and again. And so this question of why... is just a distraction. It goes off in ways that aren't going to help you. The fact of it is, here we are. Now what? Serving the soup.
Yeah, and this here we are, now what, is also related to how we meet shoulds. There should be something. I should be better at this. There should be a more effective technology for me. I should be seeing more effects. Like, so all of those shoulds are kind of other universes than this one. And so we can... And even if we stay like in this, you know, should, if you were a better person, then yeah, you'd totally be able to do something better. I will completely affirm that. But then we're left with the reality that we're this person who can't. He could if everything were different. I could if only I were better at these technologies, or had more of a karmic disposition for samadhi, or you know, just didn't have it, like, then, yeah. And so it isn't the case that once we ask a should question, it's not clear what we could do with any answer to that. And I hear you expressing, you know, dissonance around something related to this is not okay, this is not whatever, this is not fine as it is, I should be better, this should not, and often we hear, no, this is perfect and complete just as it is, right? And you find that very invalidating. Clearly not! So a different way in is, yeah, you're right. This is bad and wrong and not okay. This is what you've got, though. And in light of bad and wrong and not okay, the thing to do is this, is hell practice.
Because it's exactly the should that's the thing that I'm talking about. It's this, comparing, you know, how I perceive myself and saying, well, you know, I should be better. I should stop saying I should, you know. Because that's what comes up for me when you say, oh, yeah, well, you're just saying you should. And I say, yeah, I know, yeah, I should.
So keep saying should. Say should all you want. But really pay attention to what you're doing with that should, right? You know, I think should practice is another hell run. And hell practice is great. And I value hell practice because hell practice makes it so clear to me when I'm amplifying my suffering. Because really, I can't take any more. Like when I turn up the suffering, it gets unbearable and I really, 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 really can't cope. So the little amount of non-suffering I can obtain by just not amplifying it further becomes essential. So, keep up your valuable should practice.
I just wanted to throw my two cents on this. I was thinking that there is, it strikes me, I mean, you just said that keep a valuable should practice. I thought that there was, I mean, the first thing, I'm sorry, what is your Steve, the way that you started out, I really felt that too. About, you were talking about the teacher of no self, which to me is really quintessential insight of Buddhism. And to me, it's what makes it stand apart from other traditions, many other traditions. And you're wondering why that particular most important issue isn't sort of developing, or you're not moving beyond the element. And I have the same thoughts and worries about it. And I also wonder about that, asking the question why. I'm not sure if you refer to this capable. To call that, I'm not sure that is just a distraction, right? I'm wondering if how much value there would be in investigating as well as possible how that self is created, asking why, and then investigating exactly how is this happening, because it seems so self-evident that I am a person, that I am real, that I am here, that I am self. It seems, it seems self-evident. So I think that the investigation, trying to investigate how it's happening, how is it being made, who's making it, where is it coming from, I think that is maybe a good investigation, but I'm not sure that this practice does too much.
Well, yeah. Can I? Mm-hmm. So, in my mind, I mean, I completely agree this is an essential thing to investigate. But for me, the question there is not why, but what? What is it? That's a question that turns you immediately to looking at it. It becomes experiential. The why is more of that it doesn't have that effect for me.
Sorry, instead of why, how, which is better, or how is it happening, is more along the lines
of. Yeah, even there, I find that to be more immediate. Somehow why just goes wandering off into possible reasons and imaginings. And for me, I mean, if that's what's the useful question for you, and it does turn you to looking inward and seeing what this is, then super. I wasn't really hearing that from C. So.
And you asked a similar question maybe last Tuesday night or something, or 2 Tuesdays ago. And then sitting with my response to it, I was dissatisfied with my response, and so I'm glad you asked again. So I can dissatisfy myself in a different way. Change it up over here. So I think that part of what you're pointing to is the way that meditation and Zen practice can be used as a kind of psychological bypass, can be invalidating and negating of experience and of our own developmental history and of a certain level of the specificity of the way our mental structures interact with other of our mental structures, like so, and that Zazen meditation in general can prematurely foreclose certain kinds of questions that can be valuably looked at, and it's really important that our Zazen not be that kind of meditation. And so how do we do that? For me, the arc of my practice, I did a whole lot of meditation. You know, I hated the entire idea of psychotherapy. So I did a whole lot of meditation. And then meditation really failed me. And then I did a whole lot of psychotherapy and intensive investigation and really looking at myself and getting to know, what is going on here? Why am I like this? And getting some insights around that and really valuably coming to see, oh, here's me doing that thing, I see that. And then that helped me return to meditation in a more inclusive kind of way. Neither one of those things made the messiness that's me go away. But there was valuable stuff for me to see. And part of what I was able to see is that, yeah, it kind of makes sense that it would be like this. I can really see how that might have happened. And from that, I was able to chain more spaciously hold me being like that in my zazen and not in my zazen. And so the question, so that's a little bit with regard to the frame of why. And the frame of how is a good introspective thing to really look at. And so how is this happening right now? What is the chain? What is the series? And this is, I think, it's a form of analytical meditation, which zazen is not. But analytical meditation is a thing that is prominent in other traditions of Buddhism. It's probably prominent in Indian Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, and kind of comes back into Zen in the West by the kind of psychologizing of it. You know, because it's also present in like in the Abhidhamma. And the Buddha was a really masterful analytical meditator, and that is a way to go, and it's useful, and to the extent that it is interesting and available to you and possible, I don't want to discourage you from really looking at the inner nuances of, you know, this is like the 12-fold link of dependent arising, of how our fundamental misunderstanding leads ultimately to sickness, old age, death, you know, through all of the other chain. And zazen, and all of this analytical stuff, I think, is exactly what Bodhidharma was fleeing India from. And because Indian Buddhism had gotten very philosophical and very investigative and very like that. And Bodhidharma is the founder of Zen, is pointing to, so all that's true and fine, and we don't have to do it. There's a direct way in right now, and that's part of that, and that's part of what zazen and Zen practice as we teach it is. And all things in moderation, even zazen and even Bodhidharma, you know. And so I think that there's lots of ways of getting to know yourself. And all of them are valuable. And but to recognize that the different domains are different, you know, and not be trying to use zazen in place of psychotherapy, and not be trying to use formless meditation as analytic meditation, because then you miss out on the benefits of formless meditation and the benefits of analytical meditation. You know, and the same with using meditation in place of psychotherapy, then you miss out on the benefits of both. Which isn't to say they aren't both beneficial, and that many of us need all of this stuff.
Lots of different things come to me, but the last one, I guess, is in response to I came up against the block and thought, I can't do this. I can't. The teacher said to me, well, there's something to say. I can't. Which is why. And I thought, who is this that can? It's like, who is this that should? And in sitting with it, I saw it as something kind of constructive. And when I looked beyond the door, all that was left was a big grass that I didn't want to let go of, that felt fair. And I think in a way that contingent, empty nature of us threatens the ego, threatens the breath, and we do what we can to prevent ourselves from approaching what we think we want, which is to awaken and experience this. So that was one thing. maybe it doesn't have anything to do with it. I also felt most of my life I fled from pain or suffering myself or others. And a part of being Zazen is awakening and experience. One's pain, but all pain. That's what being awakened is. And, when we try, when I try and run away from this, it doesn't work. There isn't another way to this. And I think when you become one with the pain, it does disappear. I experienced this in grief when I was driving, and I was overwhelmed by it, and I wanted to just stop it. And then I thought, because I started practicing, well, I'll just do this. And it just lifted right out of me. So I think there are real things that happen in this practice.
I was really struck by that image of all there is a grasp. It's a very powerful image. And it's also really resonant with the Buddhist view that it's not the fundamental kind of element of being are not things but events, and to see this self as a grasp, not even grasping at or the thing grasping, but just the grasp. And then I was so feeling the entire universe, this vast empty crater, as a grasp, this one bright pearl as a grasp.
So this, we look and we see this grasp, and as a part of life, I think the grasping arises. But to say that, because I'm always saying, well, you know, so that's me, that, you know, I'm that kind of person that is wrapped up in grasping. And that identification with it, it seems to me, is the part that should be optional. Because it's a very narrow view, you know, to say, well, that's who I am.
Please to respond.
It's, yeah, I mean, that's the same thing again, which is, I should be otherwise, but it still seems to me like that there should be that possibility of letting go of something.
I'm struck by the emotional tone that came out when you said, that's a very narrow view.
So, why do I hold that narrow view?
What I saw is that that's a very narrow view. That still that view was there, but there is a piece with it. That's a very narrow view. And then you go into, but why? And, you know, and as we were saying in Matthew, that's a fine question to ask. But also see what happens. But see the difference for you between, it's a very narrow view. Oh man, the why is not just clear. And then, and so, without invalidating the question of why, and without invalidating that it is a legitimate avenue of investigation, what you can, just like with the precepts, that we keep not because they're rules, but because we kind of see for ourselves that it goes much worse for us when we don't.
But I'm not really asking why, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm not really asking why. It's just this idea that there's, I should be able to not do that. I don't care why, and I don't really care to analyze how it is coming out. I just want to stop. Thank you very much. And I mean, sometimes it's so clear that it's just this narrow little view, you know, and identifying with that tight little narrow thing. and at other times it's not like that at all. But I have this idea that I should be able to keep this space around, and not fall into that narrow view. Why can't I do that? I'm not asking. I don't really mean why.
Well, if you could.
Well, I'm not. Yeah, but see, that's the thing. I'm not sure that I can. I'm not sure that I can stop that.
But the language that you are using, I have this idea. I know you are choosing the language. And just to see the difference between, I have this idea that I should be able to be different, and I should be able to be different. Both of them occur in the presence of the arising of the mental formation. I should be able to be different. And one is bondage, and one is liberation. And both of them take place in the presence of, oh my God, for the love of God! Started this day-long set with thoughts of, man, there's nobody here. There's only five of us. There's only a Jew in their land. It's going to be terrible. What are you doing? But what a gift. What a privilege. What a joy to just have this time to be with good and wise spiritual friends looking at this great matter together. What a gift. Goes with the 47 for those.